This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Amy Winehouse was just 27 years old when she died in 2011 from causes related to drugs, alcohol, and bulimia. By that time, Winehouse was nearly as famous for her problems as she was for her music. She'd become the butt of late-night jokes and was stalked by paparazzi. The new documentary, called Amy, tries to rescue Winehouse from that narrative, find out who she was before she was famous, and trace how drugs and fame transformed her. The film is told through interviews with friends, family, and people with whom Winehouse worked in the music world. Earlier this week, Terry Gross interviewed Asif Kapadia, who directed the documentary Amy, and Nick Szymanski, who discovered Amy Winehouse, became her first manager, and worked with her for 7 years. Szymanski is now a vice president at Island Records. Terry began her interview with a clip from Amy, recorded when Winehouse was in her early teens at the birthday party of her 14-year-old friend. Winehouse sings the lead vocal on this chorus of Happy Birthday.
It's my 14th birthday evening in Bate.
Happy birthday,
yes,
to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday.
Welcome, Asif Kapadia and Nick Szymanski. So, Asif, tell us how you managed to get that footage when Amy Winehouse was 14 years old and at her friend's birthday party.
So that material came from one of Amy Winehouse's best friends, Lauren Gilbert. Lauren's family seemed to film everything, so a lot of their holidays and birthdays and parties and things like that. And Amy was in the footage all along because they were very good friends from a very young age. The process of getting the material was a very long-winded one, which came from building up a relationship and trust with all of the people I spoke to making the film. And I spoke to the people originally just by doing audio interviews, getting to know people, getting to trust them, and then sitting down recording audio interviews. And once they trusted me enough and had opened up about their story and their relationship to Amy, they then started to give us personal footage, answer phone messages, home videos, holiday videos, photographs, you know, all sorts of little bits and pieces which we sort of pieced together to create this giant mosaic of Amy's life.
Now, you had trouble convincing people to talk openly with you about Amy Winehouse, and I assume that's because the people who were close with her were very protective of her, especially considering how the paparazzi and the tabloids just took over so much of her life and made it so difficult for her to have a life. Nick, why did you agree to talk to Asif Kapadia about Amy Winehouse, and had you been protective about talking with her before?
Yeah, I mean, I'd never spoken to anyone publicly about Amy, and at the particular time I heard about rumours that this film had been commissioned and was being made, I was in a sort of bad space in my head with it all, feeling quite overprotective and a bit closed about everything. I'd spent time with Lauren and Juliet, Amy's two closest friends, after Amy's death, and we all felt very much closed outside the kind of official spokespeople or the official channels for Amy. But I did know about Asif as a filmmaker, and so I felt like instead of it being relayed to him down another conversation, you know, down the phone through someone else, I should at least meet up with him and explain why I don't think the film, you know, why I don't want to be involved and why possibly it's a bit early for the film.
So what did you tell him when you explained why you did not want to be involved?
Well, I just said that I felt the two biggest things for me was, one, it felt too early, which now I completely feel different about. And also, I was just very cynical about anyone being able to tell the story without glossing over some big parts of the story and possibly without being overly controlled. So, you know, I think I was quite honest with Asif about that. And what I was really pleasantly surprised at from meeting Asif and getting together with him was how sort of calm and relaxed he was. The whole tact felt very sensitive, and nothing around Amy for the last few years of her life and post her death felt at all sensitive. And then the absolute moment where I decided, you know what, I think this guy and this team are really solid, was when I went into the editing suite and I saw this timeline going round the editing suite with the years and months of Amy's life. And although it was kind of shocking to see something so practical put to such an emotional story or emotional to me, I've thought, wow, this team are really dedicated to trying to get this right and to trying to have a look into who's who and what's what and what happened. And I guess from that moment on, I thought, you know what? No one's put the time into Amy. No one of any intellect has really got stuck into this story. This is probably if I'm ever going to do this, it's probably now, and it's probably with this guy, Asif.
I want to play something that's in the movie Amy from early in her career. And this is her singing a song that she ends up doing on her first album, or perhaps she's singing this after the first album was released. You can help me with the chronology. And the song is called Stronger Than Me. This is her singing this at a club. Where does this performance come from? Who recorded it and where?
This was the first run of promotional activity. We got invited to the club and it was televised. So it was very early on in her promoting the first album.
You just see her with a guitar. I mean, one of the big revelations for me, there's lots of revelations making this film. I didn't realise how funny she was. I didn't realise she played a guitar. I didn't realise, you know, she had this amazing personality. And so from very early on, this footage, it's very simple. It's just in a club. There's lots of voices and people are chatting in the background. Amy with a guitar is electric. You know, she's just amazing. And you just see the talent, the rawness of it all. And this clip really shows you. It's very early on in her career. People don't know who she is, but the word in kind of certain circles, people are hearing about this girl's voice and her talent. And I think that kind of sums it up, really.
So this is Amy Winehouse around 2003?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, here we go.
Yourself be stronger than me. You'll be here 7 years longer than me. Don't you know you're supposed to be the man? Not a pale comparison to who you think I am. You're always gonna talk it through. I don't care. I always have to comfort you when I'm there. But that's what I need you to do.
So that's some footage from the new documentary, Amy. That was Amy Winehouse singing at a club in 2003. My guests are Asif Kapadia, who directed the movie, and Nick Szymanski, who was Amy Winehouse's first manager and is one of the main interviewees in the movie. So many of her songs were autobiographical. Does that song, Stronger Than Me, tell a story about a boy in her life, a man in her life?
Yeah, I mean, that was... She was writing that song was written in Miami just after she, in fact, I think she may have even been going out with the guy at the time she wrote the song, but it's it was a guy that she pursued for quite a long time that I don't think was very interested in her, and then she finally won him over and it went the other way. He was extremely interested in her and she started to lose interest in him. That's a song that came after she'd written some really warm songs towards the guy as well. So it really captures both sides of her personality, her sort of tender side, but also her more witty side.
Many young performers are driven to become stars, but my impression from the documentary about Amy Winehouse is that she was almost afraid of stardom, that she thought it would hurt her. And in fact, it did. So Nick, when you knew her, when she was first starting in her career and you were managing her, what were your impressions of what she wanted out of her career?
For me, I was so sort of excited to find someone of that talent. And there was quite quickly a really strong chemistry between her and I. And I realised that she, you know, with Amy, it was about finding the things that would make her feel focused. So early on, you know, I suppose if I look back in hindsight, you know, she wasn't that ambitious to be famous and she wasn't ambitious to make lots of money, but she was very ambitious to get in the studio with some, you know, top level musicians. She was really excitable when it came to making music, being around music. So I guess that masked at the time my understanding of what her ambition was, because there was motivation and there was enthusiasm. And I guess years later I look at it and I realise that was never directed at fame or money or the things that come with being a big star. But it wasn't so obvious because of those other things that were going on.
Her most famous song, at least in the US, is Rehab. And Nick, you're a part of that story. You wanted to take her to rehab. In fact, you performed an intervention with her. Would you just tell us that story?
She was in a bad place and it had been going on for a while. I was very worried about her. It had been long enough to realise that this wasn't just a phase. So myself, Juliet and Lauren, we sort of rallied together and it resulted in me taking her to rehab. She went to meet someone at rehab, agreed to go in on the condition that I took her to her father's house and she got his consent and his approval. I obviously stopped, called him to kind of just make sure he was on the same page. He agreed he was on the same page. By the time we got to the house, that had, you know, he changed his mind and sort of, if anything, went against the idea of her going to rehab.
And so the line in the song, "I ain't got the time, and if my daddy says I'm fine," that leads to "I won't go." So that's like a factual reference that her father said she didn't need to go to rehab.
That song's pretty much verbatim what happened that day. I mean, it was all lined up for her to go, and who knows what would have happened, whether it would have worked or not, I don't know. But we had it all lined up, and he changed his mind, and if anything, belittled my position and also my point of view, made out as though I was massively overreacting, which was a terrible message to give to her as well, I felt at the time.
As if Amy Winehouse's father, Mitch Winehouse, objects to how he's portrayed in this part of the movie. And he thinks that his full statement was edited in such a way that so that the full intent of what he's saying isn't represented. Do you want to address that?
Well, I think he said at the time, "I don't think she needs to go to rehab." He is saying, it's quite pedantic, I think he's saying in his interview, and we did more than one interview, he said, "I don't think Amy needed to go to rehab at the time." Now, he's saying you've taken out "at the time," but the point was, at that time, he didn't think she needed to go to rehab, and that's what we've got in the film, and that's what Amy says in the song. I mean, what you've just been talking to Nick about is actually a kind of interesting part of the creation of this film. I was meeting people and talking to them, and while talking to them, it dawns on me, oh my God, Nick, you're talking about something I've heard of. I know this song. And then you realise, actually, that real incident, Amy turned into a song which became her biggest hit, which became the albatross around her neck. It's the song that made her famous in the US, it made her famous around the world, and then later on people watched her singing it with a glass of wine in her hand or, you know, a vodka, and you're sitting there dancing to it. But this is a cry for help, in a way. This is her sort of trying to have a dig, or in hip-hop terminology, she's dissing Nick, in a way. People trying to help her. She turned it into a song. And I kind of find it slightly, it doesn't matter what whether it was said at the time or not, her father didn't think she needed to go. That's why she didn't go.
So why don't we hear Amy Winehouse singing Rehab from her 2007 album, Back to Black.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, I'm fine. Just try to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go. I'd rather be at home with Ray. I gained about 17 days.
That's the big Amy Winehouse hit, Rehab, recorded in 2007. And my guests are the director of the new documentary about her, Asif Kapadia. The documentary is called Amy. And Nick Szymanski, who was her first manager. He managed her for 7 years. And that relationship as manager and musician ended just before the release of the album Back to Black. So, Nick, what was it like for you hearing that song, knowing, like, yeah, you're the guy who really tried to get her into rehab? And her father did say she didn't need that at the time. And now she has a song about it, and the song sounds kind of funny in a way. Like, I don't have to go.
Well, it was a very frustrating time because I could hear what a powerful hit song it was. I knew it was a song that would travel. At the same time, I was slightly embarrassed because it was making a mockery out of me and what I stood for. But the biggest feeling was of sadness and frustration because I knew she did need to go. And I knew that by the time the actual record was coming out, she was in a worse place. And by the time everyone knew the song, she was in an even worse place. There's a lyric in it, "It's Not Just My Pride," which really resonated with me because, you know, my pride was in a bad place because someone that I had this big dream for was sort of going into the dream and I was no longer part of it. And I could see it turning into a nightmare pretty quickly.
Asif, there's a story in your documentary, Amy, about her being in the studio, recording the songs for her album Back to Black, when she's drinking in the studio, and she also has this like huge plate of food that she finishes plus a dessert, and then goes into the bathroom, and one of the women discovers that she threw everything up because she was bulimic, but no one really understood that at the time. So even though the people who were recording her at the time thought maybe that she was sober, she still had very serious troubling issues going on in the studio.
We found out that, you know, bulimia was an issue from a young age, from like her teens, mid-teens. And I think that's what came out. A lot of different people had mentioned they'd noticed it, but they didn't realise it's a big deal, or they thought it was a passing phase or, you know, nervousness. And that was a massive part of Amy's kind of illness over the years, which mixed with alcohol. And obviously there was a period of heavy drugs, but that was really a problem for her. There was an eating disorder that continued all the way through. And really people started to notice it more and more. But what I found was that lots of different people would notice it, but nobody was talking to one another. And I think that was a big revelation about the kind of Amy story, was that the different compartments to her life, different people in different stages that didn't meet or talk to one another, or in certain cases just didn't get along. And I think, therefore, Amy was able to control the situation by not everyone knew all of the information.
Well, you know, her mother, Amy Winehouse's mother, even tells you when you're interviewing her that Amy had come to her when she was in her, I think, early teens and said, "I have this great way of dieting. I just, like, eat whatever I want, and then I just kind of bring it up." And her mother tells you that she didn't think much of it at the time. She thought, oh, she's a teenager, it's a passing phase, it'll go away, no big deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the sadder things when you hear her mother talking, who, you know, she's very sweet, Janice, but she's, you know, she's talked about how even when Amy was very young, Amy would ask her mother to be tougher on her, be stronger with me, you know, I need a bit of more kind of guidance. And Amy's mother wasn't always able to be like that. It doesn't come naturally to her. So I think, yeah, she mentioned it. That was, again, another thing where you realise that from 15, 16, she'd mentioned it to her parents, and they didn't know how to handle it.
Let's talk a little bit about the paparazzi. She was the target of paparazzi. And the sicker that she got, the more drug problems that she had, the more people wanted to photograph her in any kind of compromised situation. And so you have shots from multiple points of view. It seems to me you probably got footage and still photographs from different paparazzi of the same moment in her life, of that same street that she was walking down or door she was coming out of. You have points of view from several different photographers. Why did you want to do that, and how did you get the photographs and footage from the paparazzi?
I lived half a mile away from Amy's front door. I knew that area very well. And, you know, this crazy life that she led, where she'd walk out of her door to get to a taxi cab, she'd have to pass by 50, 60 men, you know, with these cameras flashing photographs at her. And she's a tiny, petite girl. And it just seemed nuts that this was normal. This became normal. So I felt we had to deal with that and show that.
Was it hard to get paparazzi to agree to hand over their photographs and footage?
I think the way this works is once you start talking to people, if they still exist, I mean, a lot of paparazzi take the picture, it gets sent out, it gets used by a newspaper, and then they delete it. So a lot of material has been lost. I mean, the interesting thing that we should mention is Amy was the girl with the album, with that particular song Rehab, who was famous when in the UK all the newspapers went digital. So suddenly there were websites. Suddenly, you know, all of those kind of pop culture websites or, you know, the glamour ones, they're the ones that are the most popular. People want photos. Amy sold newspapers. If she was on the cover of a tabloid, it sold more copies. If she was on a website, they got more hits.
Nick, Amy was supposed to come to your wedding, and she died the day before your wedding. I'm wondering how close you were to her then. You know,
I always adored Amy. And, you know, I had a real soft spot for her from the first time I met her. I had a blind belief that she was the best. I spoke to her, you know, a few months before she passed, and she made it really clear she'd really like to be at my wedding, which I was pleasantly surprised at. And so I said, of course, you know, goes without saying, you're welcome to my wedding. And I'd heard from her two or three times, and I'd heard from people around her, you know, that she was really excited about my wedding. And I had a lot of people due to be at the wedding or at the wedding that knew Amy well and that had known Amy for a long time. And so you can imagine the day before my wedding, you know, it's one of the happiest weekends of my life, to get probably some of the saddest news I've ever received in my life was a, you know, it couldn't have been worse.
Nick Szymanski was Amy Winehouse's first manager and is now a vice president at Island Records. He's interviewed in the new documentary, Amy, which was directed by Asif Kapadia. You can hear a longer version of their conversation with Terry Gross on Fresh Air's podcast at itunes.com/freshair.
I'm nurturing. I just want to do my thing. And I'll take the wrong man as naturally as I. Covering my fears, our behavioral patterns stick over the